Hello.
Hello.
I just got a spam call. Thought it was you.
No, it wasn't me.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Fyre Festival, Eminem and The Great Escape. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. In the studio where I am not is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How's the studio?
The studio is looking particularly fine today. It's a shame that you're phoning in once again from the seaside, so there might be a slight echo on Andy's voice. Apparently, we've just been told in the unedited version of last week's podcast, you could hear the seagulls in the background, which would have added some ambiance of the fact that you're phoning in from the seaside.
Don't want ambiance. Glad it was edited out.
It was removed, so there weren't any in the final edit. But you're saying the seagulls aren't around today?
No, it's been raining.
So there should be no seaside sounds in the background. But
hopefully not.
So yeah,
Not that there were any last week.
Not in the final edit. But, you know, we might put the unedited versions up one day as some sort of, you know, DVD-style extra. And then
the 20th anniversary box set.
Well, exactly. So that'll be something for people to look forward to one day in the future. I'm going to the Spot Festival this week, which is why we've ended up Andy phoning in again, because it's my fault this week. Was it my fault last week? I think it was your fault last week.
It's always your fault.
It's never my fault. So yeah, I'm insisting that we record the podcast a little bit earlier in the week than normal. So that's why Andy can't actually be here in person. It's also why we always do this little footnote when we record early. If a major music business event happens on the Thursday, then we won't be talking about it. So
that is correct,
because we're recording a little bit early. So this is the week in music as of Wednesday afternoon is the proviso. But
yeah, but if the week carries on as it has been, there will be no big news stories at all.
No, there's just basically the one running story that we're going to be talking about later.
Yeah. And what a story.
Well, so thank God that the Fyre Festival was a complete and utter calamity. Otherwise, we would have had nothing to talk about this week. If it had just been a very slick, exciting event, well, clearly we wouldn't have reported on that.
So, we would not have mentioned it.
So we would have had nothing to write about this week. So it's good that that was a disaster, and it means we'll have a whole section talking about the utter shambles that was this new luxury music festival in the Bahamas later on in the podcast.
Yeah. Well, so we've got that coming up this week. You've already trailed that for me. We're also going to talk about Eminem taking the New Zealand governing political party to court, which is actually quite an interesting story, despite everything we just said about this week's news.
It is.
But first, let's deliver the scoop that the new Great Escape programme is out.
Yes. I persuaded Andy to let me talk a little bit about the Great Escape conference programme on this edition of the podcast, because basically the conference programme is now live online. So if you go to either greatescapefestival.com and click on the convention button, or if you go to cmuinsights.com and you click on the big Great Escape logos that are sliding across the front page at the moment, you can check out the full schedule for the four conferences that CMU Insights is presenting as part of this year's Great Escape. And on the Great Escape site
itself. What
schedules they are. And on the Great Escape's website.
Everything lined up, one after the other.
On the Great Escape website.
Start times.
And in the Great
times.
Escape app, you can access it in a scheduler format if that is what you like to do in order to plan your schedule. Because there is other things going on at the Great Escape, of course. There's all the showcases, all the bands, all the parties, all the networking. So if you insist on going to some of that, that's fine. In the evening, brilliant. Go and see as many bands as you can. We just insist that you do the Great Escape properly and you don't really plan anything and you just go and randomly discover stuff. And the best band you will experience will be the one playing next to the venue which you were going to but couldn't get in because of the queue, and you go next door and that's where the best band is playing. So do that in the evening,
yes.
But during the day.
But get a good night's sleep and don't drink too much. Be ready for the next morning's conference activity.
Friday night you can drink as much as you like, but on Thursday
you
night.
You don't have to be up till four, do you?
Well, a bit earlier
four
than
the
that.
First thing.
No, we've got some other stuff going on Saturday, but Saturday's not a proper conference day. There's some various sessions going on, both that we're presenting and that other people are presenting, all of which are looking quite cool on the Saturday. But the main conferences are happening on the Thursday and the Friday at Duke's at Comedia. So shall I quickly talk through each of our four CMU Insights conferences in turn?
Sure.
Why not? So obviously, we announced the topics that we are covering at this year's Great Escape at the start of the year. The basic running order of conversations and topics we're covering have been on the website for a couple of months now, and we've been slowly adding speakers every couple of weeks. But there is now the full schedules, time slots, speaker lineups, etc., all available online. So the four conferences are our drugs conference, our media conference, our export conference, and our royalties conference. So basically, each of those are, in essence, a conference in their own right. If you choose to sit in the Duke's cinema from 11 in the morning till 5 p.m, then basically all the sessions flow on. So unlike every other music conference in the world, nearly, it's not panel, where each one-hour panel is self-contained. Over the day, we are, in essence, taking you on a journey. We're telling you a story about the topic that is happening around that conference. Having said that, you don't have to do that. You can dip in and dip out. If you've got to go off to some networking stuff or some party stuff or some meetings, that's fine. We will run pretty much to the schedule as in the programme, and you can dip in and dip out. But should we talk about the drugs conference first?
Yeah.
So this is the interesting one, isn't it? So I think we like to try and always make sure that one of our strands at the Great Escape is pretty much different to any other conference that you have been to. So our drugs conference is on the Thursday in Duke's One. It's supported by Help Musicians UK. It's going to be hosted by the brilliant Jen Long. And basically the day is sort of split into two. The first half of the day is looking at drugs from a licensing perspective, from a sort of safety logistics perspective, starting obviously with the Fabric debacle from last year, and then looking at how promoters of clubs and festivals and gigs can work better with licensing officials and councils and the police on ensuring that we have safe festivals, but that we don't employ that slightly short-sighted, oh, the solution to stopping people taking drugs is just to shut all the clubs, because as we know, that isn't going to work. If anything, it is putting young people in more danger. So that's going to be the gist of the first half of the day. We've got Andy Blackett from Fabric coming and sort of telling the story from his perspective and the various measures that they employ to try and make their club the safest in London. We've got Sasha Lord from the Warehouse Project, so a promoter up in Manchester, who is coming to talk about the initiatives that they run and his experiences working with the local authorities up there, who actually, from what I can see, one of the interesting things with all the rules around the licensing of clubs and festivals, a lot of it happens at a local authority level. So the attitude of local councils and officials and police forces varies greatly around the country. So how easy it is to put on your events varies greatly depending which city or county or region you are in. And Manchester seems to be amongst the best in having practical, sort of proper approaches to making events safe, but without saying that the solution is just shutting everything down. So Sasha's insights are going to be very interesting. So those are a couple of people who'll be speaking in the first half of the day. And then the second part of the day is looking at drug taking within the music community. So do drugs help with the songwriting process? Is it a myth that the best songs ever written were all written under the influence of something, or is there something in that? So we'll have some artists discussing about that. The guys from Noisy and Vice will be airing a new documentary that they have made with the grime MC Jammer, looking at the effect of a skunk use in the grime community and some sort of recent developments in that respect. And then finally, we're going to be looking at sort of some of the practical initiatives out there to help artists and indeed anybody working in the music industry who get a dependency and an addiction to drugs. And so, for example, well, you're going to be interviewing a guy called Simon Mason, who published a book a few years ago called Too High, Too Far, Too Soon, who has his own personal experiences of drug addiction, but also of sort of helping other artists and people working in music. And John Stewart, who is now a course leader over at BIM Brighton, who has also been doing quite a little research on this area. So those will be amongst the contributions in the latter half of the drugs conference, looking at how the music industry can better support its artists and its people, which in some ways is a continuation of the mental health conversations that we had last year that you moderated at the 2016 Great Escape.
Yeah, I think that will definitely link up with the conversations that we had last year, and there'll definitely be a bit of crossover, though we're going deeper into the topic of drugs and addiction, obviously, this year.
Meanwhile, on Thursday in Duke's 2, I will be running the media conference, which will be looking at all things music media. It sort of all begins with the line I often use at a events, which is, as somebody who writes about the music industry but owns a media company, obviously most of our listeners work in the music business. Some work in the media, some work in both. But if you think the music industry has had a difficult 10 years, come and have a look at the music media. It's really hard making money out of music journalism in the digital age. And what you have is numerous music magazines and music websites who are probably talking to more people today than they have ever done in their history. And that includes all the sort of the classic music magazines that used to be predominantly in print back in the day, who are now probably in print and online. And through the web, they'll be talking to a bigger audience, to a global audience. But God, making money out of online content is hard, because generally speaking, nobody in the consumer media space has successfully put a paywall around their content. Some B2B titles, you can sort of charge a subscription and restrict some of your content, but generally that doesn't work in consumer-facing media. But selling advertising is really hard, because most online advertising spend goes to Google and Facebook and to social and to search. So how do you make money out of music journalism? And so we're going to be exploring that. So amongst the titles who will be there discussing the business models that they're employing will be magazines like DJ Magazine, like Grime Daily, like DIY, like Vice. All of those will be talking about the way they work with brands and the way they've licensed out their own brand and the events that they do and how they are generating revenue around their content. And then we'll have a journalist perspective on that, sort of considering what all of this means if you're somebody who writes about music. Is it having an impact on the way we write and review and cover music as the business model shifts? So people like Laura Snapes and Emily Jupp and Mark Savage from the BBC will be contributing to give a journalist's perspective. And we're doing a journalist survey as we speak. Have you filled out the journalist survey yet, Andy Malt?
No one sent it to me.
Yeah, we didn't send it to
you. I keep asking.
It is true. We've sent it to every single music journalist in the country except Andy Malt.
Apart from me.
Yeah. I think that's Tom's fault. That can't be my fault. So yeah, we've been surveying music journalists from across the country, and we'll be presenting the results of that survey at the media conference. Some of that is their opinion on the media and where music media is going and how you build a career in music journalism in 2017. But then also at the end of the media conference, we're going to be looking at music PR and what all of this means for record companies and gig promoters and artist managers, of how they engage with the music media community. So we'll present the results of our survey and what journalists are saying to the music PR community. And then we'll have PRs from Festival Republic, from Secretly Canadian, from True Thoughts, and also from Stay Golden PR. We'll all be contributing, seeing it from the other side of the fence, I guess. The way music PR is changing as we shift over to streaming in the music industry and as music media itself evolves. So that's the media conference, which is all happening on the Thursday in Jukes 2.
Okay, then, and heading into day two, we'll be kicking off with our export conference and looking at taking your band international and how Brexit is going to affect us all.
Yes, so it's two of the conversations we'll be having in the export conference, which is supported by the BPI in Jukes at Comedia One on the Friday. So yeah, the big bulk of the day is looking at exporting new artists into new markets, which is sort of the point of The Great Escape. I was once told, I don't know if this is true, but it was one of the founders who told me this, that the reason The Great Escape is called The Great Escape is it's all about artists escaping their home territory. So the bands who are playing The Great Escape, in the main, they're not brand new unsigned artists. They're artists who are already getting a little bit of momentum in their home country. They might have a label on board or management on board or an agent on board, but they're ready to go global. They're either UK artists ready to go overseas, or they're international artists looking to come into the UK or possibly Europe at large. And that's sort of from the festival side, that's the point of The Great Escape. And so we're sort of celebrating that with our export conference, looking at how you export. So both how UK artists can export globally, but also looking at how artists, wherever they are in the world, can sort of move and build a fan base and a business in new markets.
Yeah, if you look at the schedule for that, there's a lot of practical advice. That's going to be a lot of note-taking in that one, I think.
Yeah, that's the aim of the day, is it's sort of across the conversations and the panels, people will leave with some bullet points of what they need to do. So, for example, we've got the business partners, managers, labels of four artists who've received funding from this thing called the Music Export Growth Scheme, which is a government-funded initiative who provide funding to sort of independent artists or management working with artists who are getting a bit of momentum in the UK, looking to go abroad. So the artists who will be having case studies from are Public Service Broadcasting, Fearless Vampire Killers and Temperance Movement, all of whom have received some MEGS funding. And the aim of those conversations will be, well, what did they learn, which our audience can learn, about taking music, whatever genre, from Britain into new markets. I'm looking forward to, we've got Andy Corrigan from a company called Viva La Visa doing the top five visa mistakes, What is it?
Which is very relevant following everything that happened with this year's South by Southwest.
Yes. How can you make sure that you're not one of those artists stuck at the border, not being allowed in to go on the tour or the festival or whatever it is that you're looking to do? So that'll be a very practical session. We'll also have a look at the various export initiatives around the world, so government and industry-funded export offices and export programmes, and what the best export programmes look like. So Sound Diplomacy have been doing a lot of work on that, of what is best practice in this whole music export business. And from a UK perspective, we don't have an export office in the UK, although there are lots of different initiatives out there to help artists who are looking to go global. So MEGS, the Music Export Growth Scheme, I've already spoken about, but there are others. The BPR involved in some schemes, the PRS Foundation have some schemes. So we're basically going to give you a guide to all the different schemes that are out there if you're a UK artist looking to go global. These are the schemes that can provide money or support or advice, and we'll tell you what they are, who's eligible, what money you can get, and how you apply. So it'll be a very practical session. And then the Export Conference will conclude, as you said, with all things Brexit. Ian Moss, who is Director of Public Affairs at BPI, is going to provide a simple guide to Brexit. So now that Article 50 has been implemented, what will the next 2 years look like? What is the Brexit process looking like? And that will then inform a conversation where we'll be looking at the potential impact of Brexit on the music industry. So we'll have people like Naomi from the Musicians Union, we'll have Vangel from Proper Music, and Ian from the BPI will also participate in that session, looking at what impact Brexit could have on copyright, both here in the UK, but also the rest of Europe, what impact it will have on physical product, because most UK labels these days press all their CDs out in Eastern Europe. So if new duties were applied to that, what impact could it have on CDs and vinyl and merchandise? And I think Naomi from MU in particular, one of the issues where the MU will be very vocal as the Brexit negotiations are going through the motion is on live. And will new bureaucracy and costs be introduced to British artists and their teams as they look to tour around Europe? So we'll be considering all of the potential issues that Brexit could throw up for the music community. And then people like Naomi and Ian from BPI will be discussing what the various different organisations within the music industry are hoping to do in order to ensure that Theresa and Boris and Dave consider the music and the wider creative industries when they're negotiating all that Brexit nonsense.
Lastly then, and certainly not least, the Royalties Conference answering the important question, where's my fucking money?
Yeah, that's the strapline for the Royalties Conference, which is in Duke's 2 on the Friday. I'm hosting that. So if you are an artist or a songwriter, we're basically going to be looking at what happens when your songs or your recordings are utilised, whether that's on the radio or on CD or stream or download or live performance. When your music is used and money is generated, what happens to the money as it flows through the system, ultimately into your bank account? And why is it that sometimes by the time it reaches is your bank account, there ain't much money left? So we're going to be looking at all sorts of royalty flow and copyright issues. We've got people like Becky Brook, who is a real expert on digital licensing. We've got the lawyer Sophie Goossens updating us on the European Copyright Directive. Amanda Carmichael from PPL will be talking about performer equitable numeration. Simon Pursehouse from Centric Music is joining me to basically explain how sync works, but we'll also be talking a little bit about production music and original commissions. Production music will be coming up later in this edition of the podcast. So we'll explain how the different deals work when your music is used in TV or film or games or advertising. And we'll have people like Nikki Bignall from the BBC, who is head of their licensing. And we'll have Andy Harrower from PRS talking about how the money works. So we're not interested in how supervisors choose the music. What we're interested in is, what do the deals look like? What do the contracts look like? And how do the artists and songwriters get paid? And then we'll conclude the Royalties Conference by continuing the transparency conversation that we had at Canadian Music Week last month, which you can read up on that conversation that we had in Toronto on the CMU website, because Andy did a write-up of that session. But we're going to be running with that at the conclusion of the Royalties Conference. So we'll have Annabella Koldrick from the Music Managers Forum, and I'll be talking to her about the Dissecting Digital Dollar Report that we've talked about on the podcast, and particularly the stuff about transparency and all of the mysteries that exist around the digital deals and what happens to the streaming money as it flows through the system. And then we'll have people like Dave Rowntree from Blur, who will be representing the Featured Artist Coalition. Crispin Hunt, with his Basker hat on, will be talking about why it is that artists and songwriters need access to this information so that they know what's happening to their streaming income. And then we'll be talking a little bit about those companies, companies like Cobalt and BMG, and some of the indies who've really made transparency and reporting in a better, more efficient way to artists and songwriters part of their USP, and what we can learn from that, and how we can get more transparency on streaming for the artist community. So that will be at the Royalties Conference. That sort of is the summary. So if you're coming to The Great Escape, do try and make your way to the Dukes at Commedia Cinema and join us for those fascinating conversations. Andy will be there doing some write-ups.
I will, yeah. As well as doing some talking.
As well as doing some of the talking, you'll be reporting on that. And then, as we usually do, we'll then sort of run a series of Great Escape reports in the weeks that follow this year's event. But if you go to cmuinsights.com or greatescapefestival.com, you can find the full schedules on there and plan your Great Escape. And, of course, you'll find out about all of the other stuff that's happening. Andy alluded to the Saturday. So there's not a CMU conference on the Saturday, but various people are presenting shorter sessions and panels and discussions on the Saturday. We're presenting two as CMU. So we've got John Robb's Pop Question Time that we used to do. We haven't done it for a few years. We're bringing it back because...
Good point to bring it back.
It does seem like the year to get artists and journalists back on stage at The Great Escape discussing political issues. Some music-focused, but lots of other political debates will be happening there. And then, as always, we will close The Great Escape Convention with the old Heroes and Villains panel with four of our favourite music industry executives discussing, well, their careers today and the heroes and villains that they have met along the way. So, yeah, Heroes and Villains will be back on the Saturday afternoon.
So, yeah, see you there in 2 weeks' time. We're looking forward to it. Right now, on to matters of this week's actual music news. And I think it's fair to say the biggest music industry news over the bank holiday weekend and into this week is the Fyre Festival in the Bahamas, which, well, it didn't go ahead. It sort of tried to go ahead. Let's do a quick bit of background. It's a festival set up by Ja Rule and a computer programmer called Billy McFarland, neither of whom have any experience in putting on a festival, let alone a luxury festival with tickets selling for up to $12,000. That became very apparent when people arrived at the festival site last weekend.
Yeah, so you might wonder how Ja Rule and this computer programmer in his mid-20s came together, but they met each other and apparently they bonded on their common passions of, what was it, hip-hop? Well, that makes sense. Well, I think it was specifically rap that they were both excited about. The ocean, they were both interested in, and they were both big fans of technology. So so they met up, they had a conversation about rap, they had a conversation about tech, and then they started talking about the ocean, and then out of that conversation, this idea came about to stage a music festival on an island in the Bahamas that was going to be sold as the ultimate luxury music festival with those incredibly expensive tickets. But in that ticket, they would fly you to the island and then it would basically be like being in a paradise for a few days. So the fact that bands were playing and DJs were DJing, but it would be the sort of the ultimate resort experience festival was the plan. And as far as I can see, they had this plan. They then set up a website saying this is something we're doing. And then almost without thinking about it, it was then happening. It was in the diary. People were buying tickets, and then you sort of sensed there was an oh my God moment when they realised this sort of idea that we came up with, we've actually now got to make happen.
Well, lots of people have written about this and tweeted about it and Facebooked about it. There's been, you know, there were lots of social media posts from people who had managed to make it to the site and those who hadn't because the planes were grounded. Eventually, when it became apparent that this festival was not going to happen, the band started pulling out. The accommodation wasn't there. The luxury food wasn't there. They were just serving cheese sandwiches, which I think was a bit of a letdown for people. And one of the people who wrote about it over that weekend, someone who had briefly worked on the festival 6 weeks ago in New York magazine, kind of detailed her experience of being a talent programmer, I think. And she turned up, it was going to be a very well-paid job, but then she turned up with 6 weeks to go before the festival and realised there was no festival as yet. They haven't done really any of the work. Over 4 days that she worked for the festival, they kind of pulled together a plan where option one, which was the recommended option, was let's not do this. Let's try again next year. And option two was, if we can put together $50 million, we will be able to pull together something that is not as good as you said it was going to be, but will happen. So obviously that was the less attractive option. And apparently it went ahead after one of the marketing people said, let's just do it and be legends, man. I think now a phrase that person will have ringing in their ears for a long, long time to come.
I think it is an event that will go down in legends. So on one respect, they achieved it. That was an interesting article. I mean, obviously, we haven't vetted that what she was saying in that article was true. But yeah, it seems like having come up with this idea for this incredibly grand, ambitious festival and picked the island in the Bahamas that they were going to use and then put up this website and then got people interested relatively late in the day, with the dates already fixed in the diary and tickets on sale, they gathered together some people who knew how to put on a festival. So logistics people, production people, talent
who
bookers,
said it can't be done.
Who then said it can't be done and this isn't going to work and this isn't going to work. And then, as you say, different proposals were put forward. The preferred proposal from the people who knew what they were doing is, let's just call this off, but this sort of big bucks plan. And then seemingly at that stage, a whole load of the people they'd hired to do the festival got sacked. The people who weren't sacked had their fees renegotiated. And then the various artists, I think Ja Rule's role once it sort of gained momentum was to try and persuade some bands to play, and he had done that. But then once these sort of bookers got involved and they were said, these are the bands we've booked, call up their agents. And of course, the first questions all those agents were asking was, where's the money? We were promised this chunk of our fee. We haven't seen any money. And then they went back to the organisers and said, you haven't paid any of your artists yet. And they were like, yeah, it'll be fine. And well, you sort of sense, I mean, on one level, it's sad when ambitious projects fall over. And I mean, some people did have a relatively tedious weekend. I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it, that the people who actually got there, I think, had the worst time. Then you had the other people who got stuck on airplanes or in airports. The people who came out best of this, providing they get their money back, I guess, were the people who hadn't actually set off at the point at which it became really apparent. First of all, from all the social media stuff coming out of the event, and then subsequently from statements being issued by the organisers that this festival clearly wasn't going to happen. You sort of sense that the people who were involved briefly and then either got sacked or sort of resigned saying this isn't going to work were probably sitting quite smugly last weekend watching all the photos and posts and videos appearing on the social networks and on Instagram and feeling quite smug about the whole thing. As it spectacularly failed. And as you say, luxury accommodation had been promised, and in the end they had these tents, didn't they? I mean, they were sort of funky looking tents, but they were basically...
They are the same tents they use in disaster relief. So, and it did kind of look like a disaster had happened.
It didn't help that there was a bit of stormy weather the day before, which is sort of, you know, when you when you stage events on islands like the Bahamas, I mean, most of those Caribbean islands, half the time it's exotic sunshine, but they're in the middle of the ocean and they're prone for storms to come in. So half of those tents had fallen over. I think they'd had to put piping in because there was no sewage. So they'd had to build all the pipes and then they all burst in the storm. And then, as you say, I don't know what the plan was with the food, whether the food just didn't arrive, but they'd really positioned it that we're going to be having barbecues on the beach and all of this. And then, as you say, there were those pretty rotten looking cheese sandwiches on offer.
The tweet that got circulated with that was, as it said, it's just bread, cheese and salad with no dressing. the lack of dressing was really the last straw.
And then all the bands slowly bailed. Blink-182, I think, were the first to put out a statement saying, well, it was one of those we don't think we'll be able to put on a good enough show given the logistical limitations of this festival. So that's sort of code for we haven't been paid, isn't it?
Yeah.
You have to assume. And so the band started to bail. And so before the festival had really properly begun, a statement finally was put out saying, yeah, this festival ain't going to happen. Those of you who've been locked in planes for the last 12 hours, we will free you. Those of you on the island, we now need to find out a way. So basically it was a sort of evacuation of trying to get all the people who had arrived, having had their cheese sandwiches, to try and get them off the island. And then the other guy who was the founder, who wasn't Ja Rule,
Billy McFarland,
he then almost immediately gave an interview to Rolling Stone. I think almost before the statement had got out that the festival was over, he gave an interview to the Rolling Stone, and that's when it became clear that he for certain didn't really know what he was doing when he organised this festival. Well, to be fair, he was profusely apologetic and he admitted they had sort of been a little bit too ambitious. but there were some of the things he said that sort of just made the whole thing even more of a humorous shambles.
Well, one of the other things, Evan, is obviously the people have spent a lot of money on this, and people left disappointed have been offered VIP passes to next year's festival.
Yes. So despite this interview basically admitting that they didn't know what they were doing and they did, left everything too late and it was all a big horrible disaster and there was lots of disappointed people, he then immediately said, but next year... next year it's going to be great and we're going to start organising it now and you should all come and everything we promised you last year, it will be happening in 2018. I don't
And someone know. From the festival has claimed now that 81% of people have agreed to that deal, which does seem unlikely. I mean, not just because the festival, if it does go ahead next year, definitely won't be happening in the Bahamas, because all of this bad press hasn't gone down very well with the Bahamas Ministry of Tourism at all, who were also putting out statements while this festival was collapsing and have now, apparently, according to TMZ, said they will definitely not be allowing it to go ahead anywhere on the Bahamas. So they'll have to find another island to take up residence on, maybe one with sewage.
Yes, the Ministry of Tourism for the Bahamas was slightly upset that aside from people dissing the festival and the shambles that was occurring, they were also basically saying this is a horrible island in the middle of nowhere with no infrastructure. It's like we're completely cut off from civilization. Although clearly there was decent mobile signal because everybody was live tweeting this and Facebooking it and Instagramming as they were going. So,
well, there is a holiday resort somewhere else on the island.
And then there was reports that they'd been told that there would be all these sort of swimming on the beach, but then they'd been told not to go in the sea because there were sharks. But the Ministry of Tourism was putting out statements saying this is a great island, the infrastructure is there, it's just that a bunch of idiots tried to stage a really ambitious festival that they then didn't deliver. So they were trying to protect the reputation of the Bahamas. So yes, it's perhaps unsurprising that they're not willing to do business with Fire Media, the company that was set up to stage this festival, for the planned 2018 event.
The other downside to putting on a festival for rich kids is that when that festival collapses, all of those rich kids can afford to sue you, which is why they're now facing two multi-million dollar lawsuits.
Yes, so the first of those was filed by celebrity lawyer Mark Gregos, last seen in music circles representing Kesha, but also, I mean, he used to be Michael Jackson's lawyer, didn't he, back in the day? So he's represented all sorts of pop stars over the years. And I think by Sunday afternoon, so this was all sort of, the festival was all sort of falling apart on the Friday, wasn't it? And by Sunday afternoon, he had filed the first of these class action lawsuits.
Well, he found one person who'd bought a ticket to put themselves up as the first to be part of this class action. That person was seeking $5 million in damages. They reckon that this lawsuit could end up topping $100 million in damages for alleged fraud, breach of contract, breach of covenant of good faith and negligent misrepresentation, none of which sound good.
You say top $100 million there. I think when Mark Gregos was talking to Variety, he was saying at least $100 million because there was talk of there being up to 150 people who might join this class. Now, so far there's one. The guy who's looking for his $5 million. But if 150 people join this class and they all looked for $5 million, well, that would be a lot of money that they would be seeking. And this is only the first of the two class actions that have been filed as we record the podcast.
Yes, because as of now, there are two. So another lawyer, John Girardi, has launched a similar lawsuit suing for breach of contract, negligent misrepresentation and fraud, and also hits out at the way the festival was marketed.
Yes, and there's already three attendees listed as the claimants on that bit of litigation. And you mentioned the marketing there. So this festival was predominantly marketed through the social media influencers, particularly on Instagram. So it seems that most of the marketing effort was basically put into going to people who have big followings on the social networks, some of whom are celebrities that we would have heard of, others are people that you would only really know of if you were a big avid Instagram user.
And some of whom were there on site to kind of hype people up when they came out of the airport shortly before they saw what the festival actually looked like.
So that's how they managed to sell these tickets that were going for up to, as you say, was it $12,000 was the sort of the top ticket price.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what you were meant to be getting extra. Perhaps the dressing on the cheese sandwiches was just for the people with the $12,000 tickets, and that guy who posted that photo was on a cheaper ticket. But so there's the allegation that they paid all these social media influencers to big up the festival, but that those social media influencers didn't admit that they were being paid by the festival to big it up. So they were presenting it as if it was their own personal opinion that this was going to be the best festival ever, which breaks the rules. In the US, it would be the FTC who have the regulations covering stuff like
yes.
this, that if you are a social media influencer, I've said that four times now, and it's a term I don't like, but if you take a bung from a brand to big them up on your social network, you're meant to declare that you are in their pay, and the allegation is that these people didn't, and so therefore that's another technicality on which we these lawyers are going to try and sue. So both these lawsuits are suing this company, Fire Media, which officially is now planning the 2018 event. I can't see how that company will survive the legal fallout of this. So
I think the legal fallout is more likely to be going on in a year's time than the festival itself.
Well, perhaps they could build some stages around the court that this case ultimately ends up at. So
Blink 182 could play.
Yeah. So if that company falls apart, well, the other interesting thing is they are also suing Ja Rule and Billy McFarland in a personal capacity. So I suppose the interesting thing is whether or not the courts will allow that, whether they will allow the various people on these two class actions to actually go after the individuals who are behind this event in addition to the corporate entity. They may not allow that to happen, but if they do, I mean, obviously for the lawyers, you have to think suing the company, there's a finite amount of money in that company that probably has all been spent building those tents and then dealing with the calamity. Presumably the airlines will still have to be paid and all of that. So you have to think that there isn't actually going to be, certainly not $100 million plus to be had from that company. So the question is, will they be able to go after the individuals in order to get those damages? I guess we will see. But a festival that we probably wouldn't even have reported on had it gone ahead as planned, but has helped us have an amusing conversation on this edition of the podcast in a relatively quiet news week.
And I suspect it will be not the last we hear of this festival, certainly in a legal sense. And finally this week, more legal goings on. This one, something that's already got to court. It's Eminem suing the New Zealand government. So that's fun. He sued New Zealand's governing party, the National Party, back in 2014. Whenever we discuss a lawsuit like this, which is a copyright case as this is, we generally give the disclaimer that it sounds like fun, but it will be settled out of court. There's no way this will ever get to court, which is what we would have said, and I think we probably did say, about this suit back in 2014. Though here it is in front of a judge as we speak.
Yeah, actually in court this week. So as you say, this litigation was filed a few years ago and it relates to a television advert that the National Party, so they're the right-leaning conservative governing party in New Zealand. So during the New Zealand elections in 2014, this political party put out a TV ad that had a soundtrack that sounded rather like Eminem's Lose Yourself.
It was called Eminem-esque.
Yes, it was a piece of library music, production music that had the name Eminem-esque. And so Eminem's publishers, so two companies that represent the publishing rights in Eminem's output, almost immediately sued, so they stopped running these adverts. But from the start, the National Party basically said, we don't think there's a case here, we think we legitimately licensed this music, and so we're going to fight this. But as you say, we didn't expect a political party to want to have a highly public spat with Eminem in which they are accused of being copyright infringers, but it has gone to court. And I suppose back in 2014, when this story was first emerging and we were reporting on it in the CMU Daily, what the National Party said, and this was before we realised that it was a piece of production music called Eminem-esque. So at that point, we thought they had actually used the soundtrack off Lose Yourself. And they basically issued a statement, and I think one of their spokespeople said something like, it's sort of legal or nearly legal. There was some expression they used that was quite amusing. But they basically said, what's Eminem talking about? We licensed this music from an agency in Australia, and they pay royalties to the songwriters through the collective licensing system, so we're all covered, we're fine. And at the time, we were like, well, that's a bit weird, because if you do sync into an advert, so not sync on a TV program, because sometimes that is done through the collective licensing system. But when you sync music into an advert, it's very rare that the sync deal is done through a collecting society. So advertising sync usually starts with a direct deal between the rights owner, which might be a publisher, might be a songwriter, and whoever it is who is using the music. It is true that if you sync music into an advert, and you do the sync deal with the publisher and the label and whoever, and you pay some money, if that advert then goes out on TV, there may be additional royalties coming in, particularly on the publishing side, for the performing rights in each subsequent airing of the ad. So some money will come in through the collective licensing system, but generally, if it's music synced into an ad, it begins with a direct deal between the publisher and the user of the music. So therefore, in the case of an Eminem track, that would be Eminem's publishing company, so they should be aware of this. So initially, the National Party's excuse seemed a bit odd, but what we subsequently learned is this is basically library music, it's production music, it is an Australian company who have a bit of music that sounds very like Lose Yourself, as you say. It's called Eminem-esque, which is a bit telling to start with, which basically means this is a classic sound-alike case where you have a bit of production music that is being licensed. So in that respect, the National Party are right. They did legitimately license this piece of library music. The question is that bit of library music? Well, it certainly sounds like Lose Yourself, but does it sound enough like Lose Yourself that it's basically infringing the copyright in the Lose Yourself composition?
Yes, and part of the evidence presented by Eminem's lawyers this week was an email conversation between someone from the National Party and someone else involved in procuring this music, who said, I guess the question we're asking, if everyone thinks it's Eminem and it's listed as Eminem-esque, how can we be confident that Eminem doesn't say we're ripping him off? Which then obviously is presented as it being clear that the National Party knew exactly what was going on and that this could cause problems for them.
Yeah, because I suppose there are two things that the National Party could say, which first of all is, we legitimately license this music off this agency. If you think that agency is then infringing the copyright in Lose Yourself, well, you should sue the agency, because it's them who are putting this music out there. They also pointed out that some other people had licensed this Eminem-esque track and used it in videos, and Eminem's people had never done anything about that. So they were sort of saying, so why are you picking on us? You're picking on us because we're a conservative political party and you don't like that. But what Eminem's people are saying is, no, this is a straight copyright infringement case. We don't really care what the politics of the National Party are. It's straight copyright infringement, and okay, the National Party may have licensed it off this agency, but this music is clearly infringing our copyright, and the National Party themselves should have known that. And the fact that they had this email exchange where they were raising concerns that they might be accused of ripping off Eminem's music meant that they were aware of it, and therefore they should have questioned this agency and its right to license this composition, and therefore the party themselves should be held liable for the copyright infringement. But the National Party are certainly still standing their ground. The fact that they've allowed it to go to court and to be in the public spotlight is proof of that. It's tempting whenever there's a spat between the music industry and somebody in the political community. That's a frequent event, isn't it? And we've talked about it on the podcast before, and certainly during Donald Trump's presidential campaign, lots of artists hit out when he used their music at rallies and things like that. And we talked before about the issue that if you're a songwriter and you're the member of a collecting society, if a politician just uses your music at an event, providing the politician or the venue where the event is happening, providing they've got their license from the collecting societies, then actually there's nothing you can do about that, because it's a blanket license, so that the politician can use whatever music they like. However, that is not true if you sync it into a commercial, because that is not covered by the blanket licenses through the creative licensing system. So it's tempting to see this as a artist having a spat with a political party story, and I think that's certainly how the National Party are trying to spin it. But on the other side, actually, it's a sound-alike case, and these have come up before. Usually they come up in advertising, nothing to do with politics, where a brand or an ad agency has used some music, or indeed commissioned some music, that sounds very like an existing song, but perhaps if a few notes different, just so they can get around about it. And actually, that's something we talked about, didn't we, a couple of years ago at our brand strand at The Great Escape, of what you can do as an artist when a sneaky ad agency commissions some music that sounds very like your music.
And in some cases that has been, you know, an agency has been unable to license the song they wanted, so they have gone to a production music house and said, make us something that sounds like this, but not too much like this.
Yeah, inspired by this song, but not infringing this song. So in the ad industry, the whole sound-alike question comes up quite a lot, but it is just interesting that this case, A, has got to court, because usually with ad agencies a check is written to make the whole thing go away because brands don't want to be in the news having a spat with a pop star. It's not usual that it's a political party who have used the sound alike music. And so basically Eminem is going to court to sue the government of New Zealand for using a bit of Lose Yourself or something that sounds very like a bit of Lose Yourself in the advert in 2014. Another bit of evidence that was shown in the case on, I think it was the first day of the hearing earlier this week, was some market research, focus group stuff that the National Party had done, and that this music, which was very like Lose Yourself, scored very highly amongst their target audience. You wouldn't think necessarily their target audience, I suppose who they were surveying, whether their target audience would be Eminem fans. But apparently the music from Lose Yourself got a better response rating than a classical soundtrack, was one of the outcomes of the focus group research presented as part of this case. I suspect it'll be a little while yet before we get a final resolution on this, but one to watch for its political element, but also testing the old-fashioned sound-alike question.
Yes, indeed. And that is all we have time for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not tell a friend about it? Next week, we'll both be back in the studio, so it'll sound a bit better. So tell them to listen next week. Or, you know, this week, fine. We don't mind. It's fine. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Although I suspect not. I suspect it'll be a little while yet before we get...
Shush!